president has been saying for months, if not years, that we have to do something to secure our border. We have to make sure that we're protecting the people of this country. And the president is looking at all options to make sure he's doing exactly that. Congress has failed. And at the same time, Mexico has the ability to step up and do more.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders defending the president's new plan to impose 5% tariffs on all goods imported from Mexico. Trump says the tariffs are necessary to make Mexico stop the flow of migrants traveling to the U.S. border. We're going to talk about that and if this strategy could work later in the show. First, let's continue our conversations with some of the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates. They're making their way through California this weekend. Today, Washington Governor Jay Inslee. He has positioned himself as the climate change candidate in this crowded field. He's in Los Angeles today. He'll be at the California Democratic Convention in San Francisco tomorrow. I spoke with him earlier. Okay, so you have based your campaign around climate change, and trying to solve this problem, this enormous global problem. Why that ahead of everything else, ahead of healthcare, housing, college costs? I go on your website and under issues, I see three tabs for climate change, one for immigration, and nothing obviously referencing issues regarding the economy, including healthcare, issues that in Gallup polls are the ones that Americans care most about.
Well, we have a tremendous story of success in Washington State under my governorship. We're leading the country in so many respects. We've got the best economy in the United States. I've helped pass the highest minimum wage. We have the best paid family leave. We've had some of the biggest teacher and educator pay increases. We have passed what I think is the best gender pay equity. So I have a great portfolio of success, if you will. But what I've realized, and I think anyone who's looked at this, is that unless we solve the climate crisis, we will not be able to solve these other problems. Because without a functioning atmosphere, with your towns burning down like Paradise, California, with your farms being flooded like the Midwest, where I was a couple times the last month or so, with giant rainstorms in Houston and Miami Beach having to build their roads up a foot and a half so they're not flooded, this is a problem that is so urgent, it demands our attention. It is our last chance to deal with this problem. The next president will either lead this nation in a clean energy revolution or our goose is cooked. So it is not one issue, it is all the issues. And I have not only a vision to create 8 million new jobs in America across the United States, but I also have a record of accomplishment that I've actually got things done. And, you know, talk is one thing, actually getting things done is another. And
yeah, so
just passed 100% bill.
You're absolutely correct that climate change affects every aspect of our lives, from the economy to healthcare to jobs on down. But somehow this idea and this message doesn't seem to be catching on with Americans and doesn't seem to be catching on with voters at the moment. I know voters have a lot of candidates to choose from in the Democratic field, but you're not polling very high, around 1% or so. Why do you think your message, although urgent, and people, especially Democrats, are very concerned about climate change, why aren't they more attracted to what you're saying and to your candidacy?
Well, we just started. We are where Bill Clinton was when he started at this stage. We're where Jimmy Carter was when he started, which was about 1%. And so that's where you start campaigns. And we've now qualified for the first debate. We've had a very rapid uptake. I've actually obtained the 65,000 donors faster than some of the other candidates. And by the way, people are welcome to go to jayinslee.com, and they want to put in a buck or two, they can help us get to the next level to make sure climate change is on the stage and it is important. And we had about a 35% surge since I introduced my climate measures and my energy jobs package. We've had a big surge of support.
Well, you're here in California, so let's talk about some issues regarding the environment here in California. As you know, we have had a lot of wildfires here, most of them caused by utilities, PG&E in particular, in Northern California. And now there's a plan to cut power to communities when there's a wildfire risk, basically impose blackouts. Do you think that's a good idea?
I don't know the operational part of this, but I do know this. It's really important not to pour gasoline all over the floor of your house. And if somebody lights a cigarette, the cigarette wasn't necessarily the most dangerous part. And what we're doing is we're pouring gasoline all through our forests because of climate change. We know the science is abundantly clear. There's absolutely no dispute about this, that our forests are tinderboxes. They're ready to explode because of climate change that is predicted to double and more the forest fires we've had. And we share the views with Californians. Last year in Washington, we had to close our swimming pools because the air was so terrible, our kids could not go out and play. And when I went to Paradise, California a few months ago, I drove around at night. It looked like a post-apocalypse movie. Mm-hmm. And so those people know the situation. They know the score. And they know we have to respond to this crisis. That is the underlying problem.
Well, speaking of Paradise, it was in a heavily forested area. And there is news out recently that prescribed burns are down in the West, in particular in California and probably also in Washington state. This is a federal problem, right? These are federal lands where there are fewer prescribed burns happening, which is basically managed wildfires. Do you think that's a good idea? Some environmentalists are not in favor of that because obviously that adds a lot of smoke into the air and it is burning trees. But Forest Service managers say that's a good way to prevent forest fires.
Well, I believe that prescribed burns in certain circumstances, well managed, if they're done for the proper reason, can be effective. They actually don't, done properly, don't burn the trees. They burn sort of the underbrush and remove some of the fuel loading on the forest floor if they're well designed. But I want to reiterate this. This you cannot solve this problem with forest management alone. If you have millions and millions of acres of dead and dying trees because of drought and beetle kill that has been in part precipitated by climate change, there is no power that man has or woman to solve this problem. We have to go to the source of this problem. And our enemy that holds us all hostage right now is carbon dioxide and Donald Trump, who's in bed with the oil industries, which allows them to pollute our industries in unlimited amounts.
Well, you also have to work with Congress. And at the moment, the Senate is controlled by Mitch McConnell, Republican, who is not in favor of this type of legislation. You've said that if elected, you would want to do away with the Senate filibuster. But that is the purview of the Senate Majority Leader, not the president. Democrats are in the minority, so you would need to get the majority in to do that. And then eventually, Republicans could retake the chamber at some point if Democrats win a majority in the next election. And then they could undo your agenda without the filibuster. So why is that a good idea?
Well, first off, people who point out that there's obstacles in our way, you got to realize we're not made out of sugar candy. Yes, there are obstacles. The Republican majority is an obstacle. We have to hope Americans are going to elect people that understand the science of the climate crisis rather than are dictated to by the oil and gas lobbyists. And if they do that, a majority of Senate can then vote to end the filibuster and we can have climate progress in this country. And that is absolutely mandatory. Because we know Mitch McConnell is in bed with the oil and gas industry and the coal industry. He will abundantly use the filibuster to prevent any meaningful progress. And I believe my party is a party of social progress and bringing justice and ending racial disparity. And the filibuster in the hands of those who want to go back 100 years and preserve the status quo. So this is an antebellum artifact. We need to move forward. We've got so many things we need to do to get comprehensive immigration reform and racial disparity in the criminal justice system, legalize marijuana, improve teacher pay and educator pay, do all the things that I've succeeded in Washington state.
Well, Washington state, Seattle in particular, has a housing problem similar to the housing problem here in Los Angeles, in the Bay Area. Housing costs are just going through the roof. Lots of homeless people. You have not solved that problem. Few people have. How do you solve that problem?
Well, we are victims of economic success. And it is a great irony that when you have the best economies in the country, people move in droves to your state, which is a good thing. And the fact of the fundamental problem is three things. Number one, We've had more people moving to our state than we've been able to build housing rapidly enough to accommodate them. So we've got to build more housing fundamentally, and we're doing that, including low-income housing, and that's why I've increased funding over $100 million virtually every year I've been a governor. We need to do some things in zoning to make sure we can build housing in our urban core. Secondly, we need to have a much more effective mental health care system. And not every person who's homeless has a mental health care issue, but some do. And so we are reforming our mental health care system to be much more community-based to really help people get mental health where they reside, even if it's on the street. So you are right. We have not solved this problem, but I do believe that we are attacking it the way that we should to help everyone in our community.
Well, would you consider radically reworking the tax structure? Because what I didn't hear in what you just described was taxing companies like Amazon, based in your state, a lot higher.
Well, yes, we have done that in our state, actually. This year, we adopted, according to the New York Times, the best, most robust, most comprehensive financial aid package for college students in the United States. And we financed that principally through an increased tax on large banks and some tech companies to finance that, because these college educations are producing people for the high-tech economy. And it's only fair that some of the largest corporations in America make a contribution to that educational cost. So that is, in fact, exactly what we have done, and it is a right template. And if we do the things we've done in Washington State, we're going to see an improved lifestyle for Americans. And I really do believe that what I've been able to accomplish, I would like to accomplish for the entire nation.
All right. Washington Governor Jay Inslee, one of nearly two dozen Democratic candidates running for president in 2020. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, how the proposed Trump tariffs on all Mexican imports would affect California. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump says he'll slap tariffs on all Mexican imports unless Mexico stops migrants from crossing the border. The tariffs would go into effect in about 10 days and increase every month after that up to 25%. Well, Mexico is one of our largest trading partners, and this could have a huge impact here in California. Nick Vias is the executive director of the USC Marshall Center for Global Supply Chain Management. And he was just in Mexico last week talking trade with business leaders there. Hi.
Hello.
Well, describe California's trade relations with Mexico. What kinds of goods do we import and export, and how would this affect California?
Well, to start with, Mexico is our second largest trading partner in terms of what we import from Mexico. And the product that we import from Mexico varies. So it's not just an automobile parts, but the produce, you know, tomatoes, avocado, lettuce, you name it. Things that we consume on a day-to-day basis, in many cases, comes from Mexico.
So you would assume with these tariffs that would just, all that stuff would cost more in grocery stores and elsewhere.
Absolutely. I think the commodity that will be imposed by these tariffs will impact every household and every citizen in our country.
Well, car parts also, that's a big deal. Cars might be more expensive if this goes through. But Trump tweeted today, in order not to pay tariffs, if they start rising, companies will leave Mexico, which has taken 30% of our auto industry, and come back home to the United States. So he thinks, apparently, that this would be good for the U.S. auto industry. Any truth to that?
See, I'm not sure. The supply chain between Mexico and U.S. has been solidified over the last 25 years. Since 1994, when the NAFTA was originally enacted, the supply chain has been very strong. And I don't think that this is something will be uprooted because of the 5, 10, 15% tariff increases over the next several months. I think it is very well-established network that will be very difficult for companies, automobile manufacturers, to just simply take it and move it somewhere in the U.S.
So that means they would just keep keep things as they are and raise prices to account for the tariffs?
In most likely scenario, that would be the case.
So this seems like it would really punish American consumers, right?
Yeah, so when you think about the tariffs, I think the misnomer that exists sometimes that the tariff, somebody else pays for it. And the fact of the matter is that, no, we as a society, we as a consumers, we as a day-to-day household members end up paying the cost and the price for this.
Does anyone come out ahead in this?
So unlike the other trade disputes that we're facing right now, you know, U.S.-China, U.S.-Europe, I believe the trade disputes with Mexico seems to have a lose-lose-lose proposition, meaning there is no such winner because it's so broad. It is so against the well-established produce and agricultural products, and that I think at the end, I think I don't see this as any win strategy.
Well, we talked to a garlic farmer on the show last week who said that the trade war with China has been good for him because Chinese garlic was flooding the market and it was at a lower price. And now he can sell his garlic more fairly and make more money. So he was happy about it. Is there no similar situation with Mexico?
You know, I scanned around 1,300 items that we actually import from Mexico, and I did not see any distinct advantage of us as a U.S. citizens to see that we would create the win situation out of it. I think this relationships between U.S. and Mexico has been very mutual and very beneficial both ways, and I'm not sure the tariffs would actually enhance either way to gain the distinct advantage for the Mexican government or for us.
And do you think Mexico will retaliate?
My initial thought is that they really want to have a conversation and communications. Mexico knows that they depend on U.S. Trade, and the new government is very progressive in their thinking. In fact, when last week I was in Mexico, they were very optimistic in spite of how the new agreements was negotiated, and they felt that they were pushed in the corner. But the new administration seems to have a very positive outlook, and I hope that they really will work through brokering and communicating this issue about the need the Trump administration has negotiated with them about stopping the illegal immigration, that they will use that as a sort of a communication method to diffuse the tension rather than retaliate on a tariff.
Right. So, and what about the immigration issue? Because Trump says that, oh, this is all about immigration and stopping the flow of illegal drugs. But couldn't this make the immigration issues worse in that if more Mexicans are out of a job because of these tariffs, they might seek to come here?
Absolutely. So similar to when the capital flow, where the money flows, where it has the best opportunity to get the better return, the human capital, the immigration flows where there is a better opportunities. It has been since the history of human civilization. And if the economic situations were to get worse in Mexico, for example, you will see a lot more tendency to having immigrants flowing into the U.S. than we do today.
Nick Vyas, Executive Director of the Center for Global Supply Chain Management at USC's Marshall School of Business. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the drug war has made Tijuana one of the deadliest cities in the world, and that's why analysts say that Julian Lezaola has a good shot at winning in the mayoral election this weekend. He's a former soldier, former police chief. He is very tough on crime. Lezaola is known for going head-to-head with drug traffickers, bragging about his brutal interrogations, being on the front line of shootouts. In fact, 4 years ago, he was shot. Now he's in a wheelchair. He's seen as a hero to many Mexicans. Human rights advocates, though, they call him the torturer in chief and accuse him of illegal detentions and extrajudicial killings. Kate Linthicum is an LA Times reporter based in Mexico City. She's covering this race. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so he tried before to win the mayoral race, I think 2 years ago. Now it looks like he has a better shot. What's different now?
What's different is Tijuana has gotten much, much more violent in the last 2 years. We saw more than 2,300 homicides in the city last year, making it one of the most deadliest cities in the world. Tijuana is sort of having this homicide crisis because we are seeing street level gangs who are battling over the methamphetamine market, killing each other with abandon. In the last few months, it's been about 6 people per day.
Oh, wow. And so he thought, I need to be mayor to control all this. Is that what he's campaigning on?
Yeah. So Julian Leysola is a really complex, fascinating man. He's an ex-soldier who fought cartels for 25 years in the military and then entered police work. He was the police chief in Tijuana and later of Juarez. And while he was working in those departments, he did what others had not. He really attacked organized crime head on. He flooded neighborhoods with more patrols. He purged the police ranks of officers he said were corrupt. And he basically said that Tijuana was no longer going to be sort of under the control of these organized crime groups, which for a long time, frankly, had been paying off police officers and other officials. So it was a big and dramatic and many thought brave approach. Leysola now says that same approach is necessary to address Tijuana's latest homicide crisis.
Which puts him in direct opposition to the president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who has said it should be hugs, not gunshots, that, that's his line, to address the crime problem.
Yeah, a lot has changed since Leysola left police work. Not only has the nature of Mexico's violence kind of morphed and metastasized and gotten more complicated, many would say, but so has the conversation around how best to combat Mexico's violence. You know, for 12 years, we saw a military-led war on Mexico's drug cartels, you know, Black Hawk helicopters, soldiers in camo with high-powered rifles, battling local narcos. AMLO has said he wants to do it differently. He has said that first you must attack kind of the causes of violence, the things that lead people to join gangs. So he's proposed programs to tackle poverty. That hugs, not gunshots slogan that he used on his campaign really sums it all up. So in some ways, this election in Tijuana on Sunday can be seen as a referendum of AMLO's new approach.
Because Leysola says that's not going to work, right?
Yeah, I mean, he says he's a tough guy. He's the ultimate kind of machista. He says if you offer a hug to a criminal, they're going to come at you with an AK-47. That's very typical of his tough guy attitude and way of speaking.
And people seem to like that in Tijuana?
You know, people seem to like that. It was interesting to me how willing most voters I talked to seemed able to overlook the very troubling and repeated allegations of human rights allegations that have trailed Leysola everywhere he's worked to bring peace to the city. People want tranquility. They want peace. They are tired. And so it seems like he has a good shot because of that.
How did he get shot, literally, in the first place?
Yeah, so it was 2015. He had recently left the Juarez police force and was running a private security company in Juarez. He was in a car with his 2-year-old son and his wife. They pulled over. His wife got out to exchange some money since they were on their way to the U.S. border to do some shopping. A man ran up, pulled out a gun, and started shooting. Leysola was hit 4 times. He was hit in his back as he turned to protect his son, and that is the bullet that left him paralyzed from his waist down. The crime was never solved. Well, the shooter was convicted, but the intellectual author of the crime, the person that paid the shooter, never was. Mm. And yeah, Lisola, you know, who had kind of built his whole identity around being this incredibly vital, tough guy, now found himself, you know, living in a wheelchair and relying on other people to do everything, even get out of bed. He says at first he thought about dying. He said he wished he had died instead of surviving that attack. The thing that got him out of that depression was this goal of being mayor of a city. And, you know, he sees it as getting revenge.
Okay. Well, we'll see on Sunday when the election takes place. Kate Linthicum of the LA Times, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, movie reviews, including Rocket Man.
You see him in these 8-inch heels and feather headdresses, and he's just giving it all on screen. And I cannot say enough about how much he embodies Elton John. There's moments in this film where you forget it's him and you think it's Elton.
Plus, we'll talk about the new Godzilla and a horror movie starring Octavia Spencer. All that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday. That means it's time to talk movies. This weekend, Elton John on the big screen. At least he's being portrayed on the big screen in the highly anticipated Rocket Man. We'll talk about that and yet another Godzilla movie and more with Jacqueline Coley and William Bibbiani. Jacqueline is editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Hello.
So glad to be back.
Welcome back. And William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello. But let's start with the movie Ma. A Blumhouse thriller starring Octavia Spencer.
There's something off about Ma.
Seriously? She's homeless.
And her basement's pretty much the best drinking spot in town.
We can't go up there.
Shh.
What the hell?
Okay, Jacqueline, what the is going on?
What teenagers don't want to party with Octavia Spencer in a basement?
What?
Who doesn't? Well, basically, you know, young girl moves into, you know, moves back home with her mom, played by Juliette Lewis, and the young actress is Diane
Silvers,
yes. And they find out that Ma, played by Octavia Spencer, is basically the town disco DJ. She's this older lady who lives by herself and lets kids get drunk, do drugs, and have a good time in her basement. And then we start to discover that there's more to Ma than what meets the eye, as you would expect. This is sort of a vehicle, I think, for Octavia Spencer, which is great for her to show a different side. It's directed by Tate Taylor, who directed her in The Help, onto her Oscar. He pulls in Allison Janney for a role that could have been played by anyone, but we get to see Allison Janney for a quick sec, so that's great. It's a ton of fun. I had a blast with this movie. I think it's what Greta was for me, which I did enjoy, but better. I love the fact that we're seeing different people in horror films.
And so it's been like older lady goes crazy.
Yeah, there's actually a long history of that in the horror genre.
Kathy Bates.
Kathy Bates, but even predating that in the 1960s, when people like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford couldn't get major roles in Hollywood movies, they went to the horror genre. And
whatever happened
to
Baby Jane.
Exactly. Yeah. Octavia Spencer really, you know, you can tell that she's free to cut loose here in a way that she isn't in films. Like even like some of the good films that she's been Oscar nominated for, like
Shape of Water,
Hidden Figures. These are good performances, but here she's cutting loose and dominating the screen, and it's a really smart movie. I think it's a really good film that like starts off as kind of a cautionary tale about, you know, teenagers and teen drinking, but then about halfway through the movie it stops being about the kids and it's all about Octavia Spencer and it's all about what she's going through, and she is such a rich character. She's funny. She's scary. I want to see a whole franchise about Ma.
And her first starring role, which I think is really interesting that she's getting her first lead vehicle, because let's be honest, I love Octavia, but she's been playing a type of role pretty recently and very often. And I love that we're going to get to see, again, she has more depth to her. And I think this is a perfect vehicle for her to go crazy and do a whole bunch of other different things. I love what Isabelle Huppert is doing with her career right now. And I love the idea that maybe Octavia could maybe...
They should fight. This should be like Freddy versus Jason. Greta versus Ma.
I want to see an L-style story with Octavia Spencer. Like,
yes.
Seriously, Verhoeven could direct it. I would be in for it.
Great.
Sign me up.
So it's not over the top?
It's a little over the top. It builds to over the top.
Yeah.
It starts off
the
pretty plausible.
Makes it look over the top.
It starts off pretty plausible. It gets crazier and crazier and crazier. The last 30 minutes are completely insane. But I think that has a good deft tone. I think it knows that it's scary and kind of funny. And so
scary-ish.
It's scary-ish. So... It might creep you out. There's a couple of scenes that are really gross, but like for the most part, this is like riding that line between horror, thriller, and camp. And I think that's a good line to straddle.
And the camp is the key thing. I think what people are going to be maybe disappointed if you're expecting a slasher film, as we talked about earlier, is this leans more into the camp and less of the gore. So I was expecting a little more gore, and I was a little bit disappointed. I kind of lamented, thinking like, oh, maybe if there was more horror, you know, bent director. But you know what? You can't be mad about the movie that we didn't get. The movie that we got was pretty good.
Okay. Speaking of camp, Godzilla. There's another one out. It's called Godzilla, King of the Monsters, directed by Michael Dougherty.
Our planet will perish. And so will we. Unless we set Godzilla free.
Oh, yeah, sure. Let's bring him in for a beer.
No, this time we join the fight.
Okay, William, you saw this one.
I sure did.
This is the 1,000th Godzilla movie.
There have been a couple of dozen Godzilla movies. There have been, I think, three official ones in America. There was a Roland Emmerich one in the late 90s, which wasn't very good and didn't start a franchise. And then there was the 2014 version, which I quite liked, but it got a lot of criticism for not having a lot of Godzilla in it. Godzilla was very backloaded. And the new film, directed by Michael Dougherty, who did films like Trick or Treat and Krampus, it's like the mission statement was throw in every monster fight possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got every monster fight.
I want to know
possible.
If there's a Mothra in here.
There is a Mothra
yes,
in here.
There's
Mothra, there's King Ghidorah, there's Rodan, and they all fight, and it all looks really cool. And that's the fun of it. That's the blast of it. That is, they do some gorgeous shots, gorgeous imagery. There's a couple of additions to the Godzilla mythology that we haven't seen before, and I appreciated that. It is, in some respects, kind of a throwback to that kind of 90s era disaster movie, and that the humans are mostly, you know, quip machines who have like funny lines and explain the plot. And I know some people are kind of frustrated, like, oh, you said there was too much human drama in the last Godzilla and now there's not enough. Yeah, it's possible for one film to have too much of something, another film to have not enough. And I think ultimately, like, every time we're not seeing a monster fight, we're kind of like tapping our watch. Just like, get back to it. But then the monster fight comes back and it's awesome. So I don't mind that it's kind of dumb. I don't mind that the characters are kind of paper thin. I just had a really, really good time at this. You know, it felt like a ride. It felt like a ride at Disneyland, but all like the docents were like these award-winning actors like Ken Watanabe and Bradley Whitford and Vera Farmiga.
The original Godzilla was an allegory for nuclear war.
Sure was.
Is this one?
No.
An allegory for anything?
No. Well, a little bit. What happens is they decide, Godzilla's evolved over the years, and he started off as an allegory for the destruction, the nuclear destruction of Japan. And so the first one was actually very sobering and dark. And then as time went on, Godzilla kind of became Jason Voorhees, where he was the bad guy, but then he was the star, or she was, depending on the version of Godzilla. As a result, people started developing a connection to Godzilla, and Godzilla became more of the hero. Godzilla is now a cultural ambassador in Japan, for example, like officially. In America, Godzilla is actually, these two films, he's more of a metaphor for nature fighting back for climate change.
Oh, okay.
So humanity is changing the world. That's creating all of these unforeseen problems. It's releasing giant monsters, and Godzilla is Earth fighting back.
Let me guess, the monster is us.
The monster is always us, every single time. That's one of the frustrating things about this movie, though, is that if you really start delving into like what it's quote-unquote about, the themes get really, really muddled. Because, like, okay, so it's about the dangers of climate change, but who are the bad guys? Like, not the evil monsters. Like, who are the bad humans? People who are trying to do something about climate change, like the only ones. And you're just sort of just like, okay, what's your message, man? And I don't think they really have one. I think they're just trying to evoke some stuff to make it feel a little relevant. I don't recommend parsing out all of the themes, all of the great cinematic significance. I recommend sitting back and watching Godzilla and King Ghidorah fight Rodan and stuff. That part is really cool. And that's kind of the only reason the movie exists.
All right. Go for the lizard. Let's end with the big release this weekend, the Elton John biopic, Rocket Man, directed by Dexter Fletcher and starring Taron Egerton as Elton John.
So how does a fat boy from nowhere get to be a soul man?
You gotta kill the person you were born to be in order to become the person you want to be.
I'm thinking of changing my name to Elton.
But that's my name.
Yeah, I know.
Jacqueline?
Everything.
Just so, the music alone.
Yes. So I was blessed to be able to see this at the Cannes Film Festival. I was in the audience watching it with Elton John and Taron and the entire cast, Richard Madden, Jamie Bell. I cannot talk enough about how I hope all musical biopics take the formula that Dexter Fletcher did with this one, because we're living in a post-Dewey Cox world. We cannot see the way that you made the song, Sorry Bohemian Rhapsody. We want to see...
Don't apologize to Bohemian Rhapsody.
I love that they infused this musical theater sentiment. I recently saw the Tina Turner on the West End. This is what they do. They take the songs and they put them in his childhood, for example. So like Saturday Night is a Good Time for Fighting is in his childhood. They don't necessarily...
Even though he wrote that when he was in his 20s.
Exactly. So they put it in a position that makes sense for what's going on with his life. And there's musical theater moments. But then there's also the like great moment where he's writing Your Song with Barry Taupin, played by Jamie Bell. And we get to see that moment, but that's one moment. And all the other songs have a part to the film with it. And when you get to Still Standing, you will be on your feet rousing with joy. But if you're an Elton...
Standing.
Yeah, yeah. You will be standing. You
so
will
be
standing.
So it's not faithful necessarily to his life.
Not faithful to his life, but faithful to his essence. And I think faithful to the fact that he is this larger-than-life, kaleidoscope-type person. And he was very drunken and drugged out. And he had a lot of issues with depression and with his family. Bryce Dallas Howard plays his mother. And she is both amazing and terrifying. And it's, I think, very honest in that. So is everything actually what happened? No. But is it the essence of Elton John? Absolutely.
I think we get really caught up in the idea that a biopic, A, needs to be accurate, and B, the idea that creatives always have these really fascinating lives. And if you live with a creative, you know a creative. If you are a creative, you know that sometimes being creative just means sitting down and staring at a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And it's not dramatic. So you just want to take what people love about someone, their artistic mm-hmm. output, and then find a way to tell their story through the stories that they told. That's
and
a good
also
approach.
The outfits
and the music,
and the outfits,
outfits and the music.
Okay, what about now? Bohemian Rhapsody. This is same director. Yeah.
Well, sort of.
He directed the last. Bryan Singer. And
he directed like the last like week or two of production. It was mostly shot. He did a few major scenes, but yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So that movie, obviously, there are obvious comparisons, right?
Yes.
One of which is both men. We're gay,
mm-hmm.
are gay in Elton's case. Is that addressed in a different way in this movie,
absolutely.
As it was not addressed fully in Bohemian Rhapsody?
Absolutely. There is a lovely, I would like to say, sex scene between Richard Madden and Taron Egerton that is built for rewinding. I'm going to go ahead and say it. Like, get your DVRs ready, ladies. I had such a good time. But it's for the
ladies and lads.
I was going to say, as Taron said, it's for the girls and the gays. Have a good time.
You know what? I think I'm going to enjoy it too.
Yeah.
I'll be fine.
Everyone's going to have a good time with this movie. It is so much fun. And yeah, Richard Madden has a really, I think, interesting role as a villain, but not a villain in sort of Elton's story. This was his longtime manager, who also in Bohemian Rhapsody is played by Littlefinger.
Yes. Aidan Gillen.
So there's a lot of parallels. There's going to be a lot of comparisons to Bohemian Rhapsody. One big difference, Taron sings throughout in this. And one of the highlights of my time at Cannes was watching Elton John and Taron sing Rocket Man at the after party. Mm. And everyone was just amazed by this.
So he's not lip syncing.
No, he's singing. And I think it's going to be hard pressed after Rami, deservedly, I think, walked away with his best actor, for you not to make the case for Taron. I think he gives so much in this. He sings, he dances. The costumes alone, like you see him in these 8-inch heels and feather headdresses, and he's just giving it all on screen. And I cannot say enough about how much he embodies Elton John. There's moments in this film where you forget it's him and you think it's Elton.
All right.
Go see it.
I'd like to, but I think it's going to be a long, long time.
Oh, you and your puns today. And
scenes.
William Bibbiotti, film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining me now is Warren Olney, host of To The Point, the podcast. Hi.
Hi.
What's on your show?
Well, it's been an interesting week for the U.S. Supreme Court dancing around the abortion issue as it has, and it's a perfect time to talk to the producer of a documentary that's running now on PBS. It's a Frontline documentary called Supreme Revenge.
Ooh. Yeah. Revenge against whom?
Well, it's a great. That's the first question I asked him, and it's a great account of how the confirmation process for putting justices on the U.S. Supreme Court has come down to this warfare that goes on, and he traces it back to the Bork confirmation hearing when Reagan was president, and Republicans are outraged over that. But it goes back even further than that. It goes back to replacing Earl Warren when LBJ tried to get his friend Abe Fortas to be the Chief Justice, and the Republicans went after them. So it's a very interesting conversation about how the court is formed and what the consequences are.
Okay, and certainly timely, as
very.
I say, given the news this week. Warren Olney, host of To The Point, the podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
Okay.
Coming up, sports and why Drake is mixing it up courtside at the NBA Finals. The Sklar brothers are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so we're going to talk about sports. There's a lot to talk about, so let's get to it.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Well, the Toronto Raptors took Game 1 of the NBA Finals against the Golden State Warriors last night. Rapper Drake, well, he kind of stole the spotlight. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the French Open. We're going to talk about the Lakers, the Dodgers. So much to talk about with the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I know
How
you're on the
you?
Phone because you are in high demand flying off somewhere to be fabulous, I know. But
that's right.
Before you do that, let's talk about the game last night. The Raptors beat the Warriors, which is
we got
that
ourselves
surprising?
A series. A little bit. I mean, listen, the Raptors had home court advantage, which is always helpful in these series. What's amazing, let's just take a brief moment. We're right now in the NBA Finals. As well as the NHL Finals, there's a Canadian team in the NBA Finals. No Canadian team in the NHL. That is crazy to me that the Toronto Raptors have made the finals like long before. I mean, a long time ago, the Maple Leafs were in it.
Yeah.
But like a long time ago. So to have Toronto and Canada be in a postseason in a championship is exciting for the whole country. So I think this is the Warriors. You know, they've been in it. They're trying for a three-peat. They've been in it several times. Not that Oakland isn't past it, but this is really exciting. So I think Toronto and the home court advantage, they were pretty hyped. Did you agree, Jay?
I agree, and I think we got to talk about the Drake factor.
Yeah.
First of all, Drake has sideline, you know, courtside seats, and Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, sat down with Drake before the game to talk about his behavior like I would talk to my children.
Wait, what is he doing?
So
he'll walk over and give the coach a shoulder massage. Like, stay away from the coach and the players. Drake, you can be like Spike Lee. Spike Lee was the best with the Knicks in the 90s when the Knicks were good, and he would try and put a hex on the other team's players. It was great theater. But Drake is literally crossing the line and stepping into people's personal space, which, fine, he's so excited that the Raptors are in there, but come on, man, you got to know where the line is.
Right, but he's Canadian, so I get that. But doesn't he also have tattoos celebrating
the
Warriors
is,
on?
Yeah, he's got a tattoo of Steph Curry and Kevin Durant, and he wore a sweatband to cover it up. You know the way when you're a fan, you wear a sweatband to a game you're watching?
Yes. It's fashion. Come on.
Well, yeah. No, but I mean, what happened at the end of the game, as the Warriors were walking off the court, Toronto had just won, Drake confronted one of the Warriors players, Draymond Green, who is an instigator. He's the kind of guy who stirs the pot. If you aren't a Warriors fan, you hate Draymond Green. If you are a Warriors fan, you love Draymond Green. And Drake got in his face and they had words.
Yeah, but this is probably good for ratings, right? More people would tune in to see this.
Oh, yeah. And Drake has even inspired Smash Mouth. Yeah, remember Smash Mouth? Somebody. All right. These guys who are, I guess, Oakland natives, I guess, is what we're finding out about Smash Mouth. They angry tweeted at Drake. That stuff isn't going to fly in Oakland. So now Smash Mouth is trying to create a beef between them and Drake. Drake, a star ascendant, Smash Mouth, a country fair staple. As it were.
Ooh, them's fighting words from you.
Well,
guys.
Listen, Smash Mouth, you got a problem? Well, start taking up with us on Twitter at Sklar Brothers.
Let's move on to the French Open. Serena not there. I mean, she's there, but she's not there. If you know what I mean.
She's there, but she's not there. She's a new mom, and not even that new. But like, I think we're seeing the downside or the sort of the twilight of just one of the greatest sports careers ever, and it's time for the younger players to move on. It's interesting because in the men's game, Novak Djokovic is the number one player in the tournament. He's won, I believe, the last four Grand Slams. He kind of had an injury and was dealing with that for an entire year. A couple years ago, he was out and then came back and had a rough year, but has now come back stronger than ever. And he's a guy that's been around for 15 years. You think about the other top names in the men's draw, Roger Federer. He's got, you know, over 20 Grand Slam titles. Rafael Nadal, who has won the French Open numerous times. It's kind of the same names over and over again, whereas you're seeing with the women, there are some sort of newer names coming. It's a little more parody there. It's not like the Williams sisters dominating every year.
Well, talk about Naomi Osaka. She's only 21 years old. She's the star, right?
She is amazing, and she actually had a huge scare in her first match where she lost the first set 6-love. Now, in the women's game, it's only three sets. Right, 2 out of 3. So you lose the first set, you're in a deep hole. If for some reason you get broken in the second set, meaning they win a game off your service, you could lose the match very easily. And she lost 6-love in her first, brought it back and came back. And it's those types of matches that I think make champions. When you're down that far to come all the way back, that's pretty amazing.
All right, moving on to baseball. Dodgers are doing really, really well. Cody Bellinger especially.
This kid's unbelievable.
Cody Bellinger, he came in the league as a rookie, and he had an unbelievable season. Then he kind of trailed off a little bit, and people thought, well, maybe pitchers have figured him out. But this year, he's putting up unreal numbers, and he's driving a great Dodgers team into first place. And it feels like the Dodgers feel stronger than they've ever felt. Am I right, Rand?
They do, and I think you're looking at a National League that's not as strong as it typically is. So, I mean, yes, we're sort of at about a third of the season gone, but I don't see a team right now catching the Dodgers. Literally, they have the best record in the National League. The pitching is great. The hitting is great. And again, you've got a guy, a workhorse like Cody Bellinger, who is in his, you know, after a couple of years in the league, his star power is rising to the top. His swing is so sweet. He's a kid that could flirt with 350. There was a time when we were kids watching baseball where, you know, Tony Gwynn hitting the 390s, George Brett hitting the 390s, like 400. 400 is the last sort of that was Ted Williams hit it in the 1950s. That's something you'll never see again. I think Cody Bellinger could flirt with 350, which is kind of like the modern day 400.
All right. We talked about trash talking with Drake.
And Smash Mouth.
And on Smash Mouth.
Smash Mouth out
I
of it.
I will not.
Madeline, you're an all-star, okay? Get your game on.
Well, let's bring it full circle and talk about Magic. Magic Johnson, he's talking a lot.
Randy and I have said this. The Lakers are like your aunt who's drunk at a wedding and grabbing her keys and getting into the car. And like,
you know, something's going to happen that's not good. Everyone's trying to stop her. The Lakers had the most dramatic offseason in the last 2 weeks, Jay. You can explain.
Yeah, Magic Johnson is going on ESPN and talking about Rob Pelinka, who's the general manager of the Lakers, and talking trash about him, about his own organization. He's done with the Lakers.
But why is he doing this? He's out. Well, he should just move
on. It's interesting. In Magic's defense, Rob Pelinka is not a loved guy. There are many people who talk trash about Rob Pelinka.
It's not like you were a former player and you became a general manager, or a coach and you became a. He was an agent.
He was Kobe's agent, right?
Yeah, yeah, he was Kobe's agent. And in coming from the agenting world, I think he handled himself differently, and Magic didn't take kindly to it. And
well, now what's interesting, what's interesting, Jay, is that, you know, ESPN came out with a huge story about a bunch of employees of the Lakers who felt like Magic created a work environment that was hostile and difficult to work in. He fired people. And, you know, with Magic's explanation on ESPN with Stephen A. Smith was, if I would have come here and I would have had all of my people hired. He's like, I inherited Luke Walton as a coach. I inherited a bunch of these employees. If I would have had my people in there, then you can criticize me if we don't do well. So he's kind of saying, I didn't have my people in there, and my people didn't understand the way that I operate. But then again, you go back and forth. Magic Johnson, it was said that he had a person on his personal staff whose job it was to warm his Twizzlers. To actually, with the Twizzlers were cold, they had to like warm them up. That's a power move.
Really?
Do
people want a warm Twizzler just
always,
in general?
Always. I think you don't want a warm Twizzler beats cold hard Twizzler any day.
Randy and Jason Sklar of the Sklar Brothers. Check out their sports podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, Michelle Alloy, Grooving to the Tunes.
Hey, Madeline.
Hi. talk or dance?
I might just dance, but we'll talk about... I was hoping we'd get a little Elton John Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, so we can talk about this beef between Drake and Smash Mouth.
I know. If only Elton John could get in there.
I know. Team Elton.
Yeah, he would solve that immediately.
Well, we ran a Twitter poll today to ask who people are rooting for in the NBA Finals. Raptors taking it away, 52%.
Really? Seriously.
What? Golden State fans, get in there. Drop some boats. Box out the haters. You guys are
behind. I'm surprised.
I know. I was too. I mean, I guess it's
LA.
I'm
not pleased with that.
No.
Not happy with that.
People love an underdog. 25% want Drake to win, so...
Even worse. Okay, thank you, Michelle Alloy. And that is it for our program for today and for the week. Don't forget, if you missed any part of this show or any previous shows, or if you want to listen to them all over again, we podcast every day. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our producers are Michelle Alloy, Yael Evan Orr, Alex Trigvadottir, Rosalie Atkinson, Rebecca Mooney, Gabriella Luce, and Adriana Cargill. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer, Amy Ta, our digital producer, Mike Stark engineered, Mario Saavedra is our technical director. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic weekend. I'll see you on Monday.